He moved back to the country he came from for a period of time with his father. Oh, his mother left them, disappeared for 2 years. Said she was going to meet them in, let's say, Colombia, whatever country it was, and she never showed up. She just disappeared for 2 years of his life, from 7 to 9. And even though there was nobody there with him, I mean, his father was there and they were in a poor neighborhood. He got more love and nurturing from the aunt living in this little house with six other kids than he ever got from his mother. So it's kind of a weird message, like, yeah, even poverty can be loving and nurturing. And, in a way, I was better off without mother. So when he did the reparenting exercise, he replaced his mother with the aunt that was so nurturing when he moved to the other country. When mother would show up, things would go badly. In his body, I think the tumors, a lot of it was on the mother's side, the left side of his body, if I remember correctly. And that's why we also ended up working a lot with the mother issues, but always feeling unsafe, unsupported, unprotected. The neighborhoods he lived in, they lived in like Colombia, where there are drug cartels all over. The neighborhoods weren't safe. He wasn't even allowed to go out of the house, almost for months or years at a time. He was forced to live there. And then they moved. And when he went off to college, he felt better. And it's interesting because some of the side effects of the memory stuff and the cancer was that he would lose strength in his legs, especially his left leg, which is mother, not there, absent, gone. There's no between 7 and 9, like his lower leg, the calf where he'd feel the pain. That's the years mother was gone. She just abandoned them, left him. He was not even there. So it's always fascinating to watch where the pain shows up if it correlates to the map that we're using, like 7 to 9. Yeah, that's below your knee. Yeah, now my calf feels, I was so weak in my legs I could hardly walk, when I was like 7 to 9. And so he described his life for those years like walking on eggshells. I would always be screamed at and yelled at by other people. Mom's not there. Nobody's there to protect me. So a lot of this stuff came up from his childhood, the early childhood history. So we never directly worked with any pain, and he's never had pain in his brain. He saw pictures of it, but all these other things when his lungs and safety and his legs, mobility, walking through life. That definitely, and when he went through the chemo with the brain, then the legs did get weak. So there was a correlation between the brain cancer and the leg vulnerability. So we worked on it from the legs. His body showed us that link. So anyway, that's kind of like the lung brain cancer client, but it really went to, if you look at lungs, look at safety. Look at safety issues when there's respiratory distress. A lot of children that were premature look like they have asthma when they're born. It's like they're struggling for breath. Is it really safe? They're separated from the parent. Some of them were jaundiced and separated and put in incubators and separated from the parent. There's a safety issue that's often tied into the whole breathing profile. I worked with the guy president, head of the one of the trauma centers in South Florida, and I did one session with him about his birth, his asthma at birth, and he never had asthma again. He's the one that texted me and said, "I have a research program set up with the VA. We'll do this all for you. All you have to do is give the technique over to me and the university." And I'm like, "Yeah, like that's gonna happen, right?" He was trying to zap our intellectual property rights. So anyway, but his asthma went away, and he was all excited about that. If it works as well for me, it ought to work for the vets. And I'm like, "Yeah, it really should, right?" Right, Karen, it ought to be working for the vets. Okay. All right. So we did the hip replacement. The other guy that came up was interesting. And have you worked, how many of you have worked with people with tinnitus? Some say tinnitus. Tinnitus. In England, when I did workshops, they called it, "Ew, I have a problem with tinnitus, with ringing in my ears." Oh, Antoinette's passed out. Antoinette, you still there? She's unconscious. She's in her TV room. Oh, okay. Look at that. You're so cute. Okay, tinnitus. All right. So his two events, he had an impact playing football at 18, several impacts to his head. So we reframed his football. You think he had about 8 football concussions. So he doesn't remember them separately. So we kind of tried a large reframe, and then one of the most significant that he remembered. And that was helpful. And the big thing was younger than that. So that was at 16, 17, 18. The tinnitus started when he was 15 years old. And we did not resolve it. So I've seen tinnitus resolve if it's memory based, if it's that kind of ringing. I've seen 50% go away if 50% of it is memory based. And I've seen it completely untouched because I think none of it had to do with memories. It had to do with some kind of brain thing or damage to the brain or some kind of structural anomaly in the cranial bones. So I don't know what, you know, tinnitus is a ringing in the ears. That could be done probably by 100 different things, different sources. So anyway, at 15, they were shooting guns at his friend's house, and they did not wear ear protection. And at the end of the shooting of the guns, his ears were ringing pretty badly, but some of it subsided after that. But for the most part, the reframe on that was obviously wear ear protection or just don't do it. He preferred to wear a lot of ear protection and walk away if it got irritating. So he reframed the memory at 15 that way. At 23, and it subsided a little bit, was always in the background. So I think he actually damaged his hearing from the gunshots. Now there's a possibility that there's an anchoring memory from remote past that's maintaining this. Sometimes you find this with physiological pains that cannot be explained by memories in this lifetime, or there's a physiological factor we don't know about. But he went to something maybe you all are familiar with, it called Coachella. You're familiar with Coachella? It's some kind of a music concert. And he went to a Coachella music concert, and he wore triple earplugs in his ears to try to keep things from going, but it was so loud, and the people he was with eventually dragged him forward towards the speakers, and the speakers were just so ridiculously loud that by the end of the concert, his pain level went up to, he said, like 15, you know, but it escalated the damage that was already done from the gunshots. So at 23, it escalated, went to a whole new level, and never came fully back down. It stayed there, but it was event induced, but it is through, you know, it's definitely hitting his ears. It's some kind of an injury from sound increase. And then the bigger thing was when it escalated and then it did drop down somewhat, I think, after that. But at 35, he's at a bar just talking to some military people. And I don't think he even remembers what he said, but he said something that obviously upset one of the guys. When he turned around, the guy just decked him and he hit that exact spot in the jaw where you can pass out. So he actually knocked him out and he fell to the floor and was unconscious. Now that brought the tinnitus all the way up to a whole new level. And punched out after that, hurt, shock. So we reframed that. We reframed all of these memories, actually. We redid the punch. We redid the Coachella. We reframed the original impact and so on. And was there anything else that contributed to that? I don't think so. Just some other emotional issues that we worked on. We shifted channels and we moved away from the ears. In the session, he started at like an 8.5. And he ended at a 6.5. So it didn't reduce a lot, but 2 points, he's like, I'm grateful. It's down, it's less. And at one point in the reframes, it dropped below that, went down to a 5. But when we brought up one of the other memories, it went back up a little bit. And it did drop down a tiny bit. So I'm hoping that he kept using colors and released it. So I think some percentage is actual damage, unless we're missing the memory, but he couldn't find any other ear pain related memories. So when we did it, anyway, it dropped down to about 2 points and he had some improvement. You know, with the technique, you learn to do your best and release your attachment to outcomes. We just don't know which, if they try, it'd be nice if everything was memory based because HMR does work really well with that part. Some of this was not. So I think he actually did damage his eardrum somehow, or had very sensitive ears, and the gunshots at 15 did real significant damage. So anyway, those are three medical cases just right off the top that people came up with, you know, and again, it's letting the body map this complexity. I don't know of any technique that gives you the ability to map medical complexities and to reframe them sequentially like HMR does. The client's body will take you through the sequencing of the memories and the complexity of the patterns. So it's kind of exciting, actually. I'd like to see this taken to cancer patients, take it to those with these chronic pain conditions. I really do want to see us in chronic pain clinics and where it goes. We can have some impact to the extent that it's memory contributed, memory exacerbated, it will improve. To the extent that it's not memory based, then we're going to have challenges, right? Okay. Any questions about those cases? No, everybody's happy as a clam. So any other questions or cases or things that you wanted to bring up that have been going on?
A couple of things. I've had a lot of ear cases recently as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about this particular client you had. The ones I've had is the ears are trying to block something like mom and daddy screaming horrible things at each other.
Yeah, that's the most common thing we see,
or,
right?
Sure. Our mother saying negative things about me personally, mm-hmm. and my ears block it or develop a tumor or something over a period of time. And one other fun thing I wanted to relate to the group, I talked to Antoinette today and she said, be sure and bring it up. I have a recent client I've met through some networking through Bessel van der Kolk's group. And she, in the last 20 years, she has done almost every type of therapy I've ever heard of and more beyond. She's written two books and she's now on chapter 27 of her memoir, and chapter 28 is going to be what HMR has done for her that the other therapies have not done.
Oh, cool.
And she's also, I think she's taking her classes as well. But she said that, she said, you know why the 9 questions work? And I said, no, why do the 9 questions work? You know, she's analyzing it at exciting levels to me. I love talking with her about it. Mm-hmm. And she said, it's because the 9 questions are all individually needed to access the different neural pathways in the body and the brain. She said, each one is activating something different so that the entire body is engaged in the icon, the identification of the event. And I just love that explanation. I wanted to share it with you guys.
Nice. Although, you know, each of the 9 questions is helpful, but a lot of times all you need for the memory to reframe is one item, one pathway that works. And that's because, you know, she's working from a science perspective and she's right. She's activating all these different holographic senses. But if all the senses are holographic and consciousness itself is holographic, all we technically need is one of those holographic channels to be accurate, and it will access all of the other related channels. So it's nice that she wants to be that detailed. And yes, sight, smell, sound, taste, touch, feeling, have a shape, size, colors, have a depth perception. So yeah, we are super activating. By the time you got 2 items from your client, you're on your way to the memory. You're probably going to get the age and location. But she's right in that if you want to be thorough and access the entire system, what you notice is when there's resistance, you go back to the body and continue filling in the 9 questions. Go back to a part of the body. And the body, if it's resistant, it might start with 1 or 2, like, no, I don't know anything, maybe. Well, how does your body feel now? Well, now my throat is tightening. Well, now my stomach is kind of nauseated. Now, you know, I'm feeling, so they'll go to kinesthetics, they'll go to other channels. So go back to the body. If you need to fill in all 9 questions, by the time all 9 are there, they're in the chair having the memory, okay? The resistance is overcome. Because one item brings in the hypnotic trance, 2 items, 3 items really articulate it, 4 items, 5 items. If you work with a person with eidetic memory that has complete recall of the whole memory, you say, does it have a shape? Oh, yes, it's a hot air balloon with silver nylon strings hanging from it with an African rattan basket hanging below it with sandbags that are kind of a beigey tan color with a little bit of silicon combination in the sand, and that it's weighing itself down and there's a green mat on the inside of the hot air balloon. I'm like, what the heck is that? They'll give you 45, 50 items, but it's the same memory. It's just people's perceptions of it. And some people are a little more resistant and their body's like, I'm not going to overwhelm you with the metaphor. I'll give you one or two items. And others are like, oh yeah, I can see the whole thing and all the details in it. So some people are a little more auto-hypnotic. They do access their own trances faster or slower. But you're right, it's fascinating to watch. But that was nice of her to observe that. Yeah, we're using, I have no doubt, you know, did they ever prove that the mind and all the senses function? I thought about this a while back. I put that in my books. Did anybody ever really prove that the mind and all the senses function holographically? I'm like, well, I could tell you anecdotally that I've replicated it 150,000 times in the memories I've worked on. Some of you have done 50,000, you know. Scott, you've done it on 3,000 women. How many memories did you work on? And like, did it work? Well, yeah, the heck it worked. This is how the nervous system stores data. Now, has anybody ever written a book on that memory is holographic? Michael Talbot wrote The Holographic Universe. But has anybody shown the proof, the data, case studies, just to show that the fragment contains the whole? So thank God your entire traumatic event becomes the little lump in your throat. Except these weird metaphors that come up during HMR, people are like, what the heck is that? What's this black spiky spinning mace head thing in my throat? You know, and people watching this video will be like, yeah, what the heck is that? You know, why would that be there? Now, some of the metaphors are obvious, like, oh yeah, there's a burning handprint on my face and it has a ring mark on it. Oh, that's my stepdad with the wedding ring backhanding me all the time in the face. I'm like, okay. Some of them, eventually we figure this out. They're obvious. It's obviously a piece of the scene that the body's using to contain the entire event. But has anybody ever, we work on a series of premises, even with Mary Gaddy, we're trying to set up a research project out of the Billings Clinic. So she and I are jumping on that right now to set up a research project out of the Billings Clinic that, and they're pretty strict. I mean, they got some real researchers there. They're going to want very fine details about the group, the size of group 50, the exact protocol, how the energy, I mean, the whole thing is going in. But it's fascinating because they're like, well, the questioning sequence needs to be very specific, you know, and precise about that. And one of the little nerd researchers, pardon my English, but I'll call them nerd researchers, says at one point, you know, you're working on theories that have not really been fully accepted in neurological schools of thought. And I'm like, well, yeah, the notion that all of your senses function holographically, where you and I are using this practically every day, every client we work on practically, and it works and it brings it up and it shows it and the pain is gone and the headache goes away. So do you need the research data to go forward? No, but our physicians and the treatment centers and everybody around us needs the data. Like, okay, as an empath, I felt it come up and I felt it leave 150,000 times. So is the data gonna prove that what we're doing actually does what we know it does? Well, I'm just saying that, but that doesn't count for anything in the world of empirical data that Brent, you know, felt this come up, but my clients felt it come up, and my clients felt it leave. But self-reporting doesn't even really account for very much in the end. It really has to do with what do the instruments tell you and show you? Is it leaving the body? Are all memories? Yeah. You know, so I proceeded 10 years ahead, like, oh, okay, this is all working and holographically working. And it appears that I'm able to feel the charge of the memory coming up the way my mother felt when we were hurt. And then 10 years later, scientists proved, yes, your brain does not know the difference between the original trauma event and the intact memory of the event. The brain waves look the same. So it took them 10 years to figure that out. So it probably will take them another 25 years to confirm the hologram theory. Like, okay, that's fine. But in the meanwhile, this is the way, quantum physics has proceeded. It used to be you can't proceed to C until you proved A and B. Then once you prove C, you can proceed to D and F. But in quantum physics, they quit doing that. They're like, we don't know how the hell it's working at B, C, and D. But by the time we get to H, now we know why B, C, and D are working. So we've actually proceeded with scientific method with our research the same way that quantum physics did. Go with what is evidently producing a measurable, significant result, and then find the theory and the physics behind it as you proceed. Because once we hit down here, we're like, oh, now we understand how this happened. So we kind of did that. We sort of put the cart before the horse in that we've been using the hologram principles and the assumption that all senses are holographic. And we've been doing it effectively for 30 years now. You know, I have anyway, you know, for 30 years. And like, is it proving true in your experience with your clients? Yes, that's why we're all here. We have something that works. We're just hoping that science catches up with us. And we're trying to make science, enable science to catch up with us. Like, okay, it is science. This is not woo-woo. This isn't some theory. We found a really streamlined way to talk to the body-mind in a completely, almost completely client-centered, body-centered manner that bypasses the need for traditional hypnotic inductions, in most cases, uses the natural holographic principles of the body to gain access memory and to allow the client using their own safe language transmit their own proof of safety. They are dehypnotizing themselves from these moments of overwhelming pain. So we don't have to hypnotize anyone any longer. They're already hypnotized. We're simply creating a safe enough space for them to dehypnotize themselves from where they've been stuck since the day, the moment the trauma occurred. And since 95% of the mind doesn't even operate in linear time, we're just trying to teach people that they're not actually still in the past event and they're actually in 2021. So yes, does it work that way? But that's fascinating. I like that the, they use other languages and whatever people want to use to articulate how this works. Karen, I was thinking, I don't know, you want to think about in the cases that you're going to publish in the book, you may want to think about inviting Lawrence. Now we could give him a little percentage of the income or something, but inviting Lawrence, do we want a chapter at the front of the book about the latest understanding of the science and how it works, or even in an appendix at the back? And I want you to think about that because that book is real. I'm letting you spearhead that. If you want me more involved, less than I, but I'm okay with that being kind of like your book, your project there. I will be glad to contribute in whatever way I can, but I kind of feel that's important that I not be the only one that writes, publishes, or does this on these subjects. But do you want some of the, well, Lawrence has really been moving forward in all pulling together all the research data about how HMR is working. Mary Gaddy, I know, is working for, she's going to publish an article on how the different drug benzodiazepines. I found a case the other day about a guy who was given benzodiazepines. I forgot what he was given to him for. And they put him on Klonopin to deal with something and trying to get off of it. They literally had to induce a coma to stabilize his system. The benzodiazepine detox had such a horrible effect. It had such an impact on him. They literally needed to induce a coma for a period of time in order to safely detox him from Klonopin. And it's one of the less injurious benzos from what I can tell. So I forwarded that article to Mary Gaddy. It was like a horror story. And he's a psychologist that was actually given Klonopin to deal with some kind of a situation, crisis that occurred, and he had to be induced into a coma to get him back off of it. So we're learning a lot more about the damage of the benzodiazepine group, and Mary Gaddy is going to publish an article on which drugs are affecting what. The more I do the work, you know, it's clear that marijuana and alcohol both inhibit alpha theta to some extent. It disrupts dreams. You're not getting alpha theta sleep. They know that from the alcohol, and they know from the marijuana, you're disrupting dream state. So it's disrupting alpha theta and the nightmares stop. So both marijuana and alcohol have a memory repressant function. They are repressing alpha theta relaxed sleep access. And so people are being injured by the lack of rest and lack of sleep and the lack of alpha theta. So people ask about that. We have that much information as to the CBD thing and all this other stuff, less of an issue at this point, but Mary Gaddy's going to check that out for us as well. Now, some of you found the CBD helpful, so that's like not an issue at this point, but we are going to look at all the groups. I've had more and more about like ayahuasca and some of the psychotropic drugs, you know, and people having good experiences. If you're in a safe, loving, nurturing place in your life and you've cleared your traumas, when you blow open the door to the subconscious with mushrooms or a psychoactive substance, then there could be nice things on the other side of the door. If, however, you have not ever dealt with your traumas and you're looking for a quick fix, you and I are going to be, you're going to find people that decompensated using psychoactive substances like ayahuasca and other things, that the perpetrators are on the other side of the door. And then we're going to have to try to help them reground and create adequate safety. That has happened. So, but I had somebody this week who had a good experience with ayahuasca, but they had done a lot of healing work prior. But they did still feel like their chakra perception was a little bit too fluid, a little bit too, a little bit less grounded, less structured maybe than it should be. But anyway, these are things that we can be aware of. Okay.
Brent, I would love to have Lawrence's documentation and input for sure. And any of you others who have special stories like David's with the little girl with rheumatoid, any of those stories, comments about how HMR has helped you or your clients. Right now, I think I'm going to have something in each chapter that'll just be a little blurb of a story or a comment or a term, like how graceful HMR is versus other types of therapies, you know, anything like that to just keep the interest and let people know how many people have been touched by this work.
Karen, do you want more medical stories, or do you also want the more spiritual stories?
Probably both. I guess I'm leaning toward the medical, but I'm having podcasts now and a lot of different opportunities to explain all this, and I'll give credit in whatever level you guys would appreciate credit. But it seems like there's so many people wanting to know so many things. So I'm trying to keep all this data I'm getting from all of you so I can use it wherever it seems necessary, whenever, to help promote. And the medical for sure, we're really getting into that, but the book is gonna include the spiritual stories as well.
Yeah, I'll definitely send a few more stories. I just this week, long story made short, I'm working with a complex regional pain syndrome patient that the hand physician that did the surgery after her fall in February, after she came out of surgery, she had the complex pain, regional pain syndrome. And 10 out of 10 pain, been treated by occupational therapy. He had done some injections. The occupational therapist wanted to refer her to me. I had a talk with with him about what it is that I did. And then I saw her on Monday, and she went right into the memory of the fall. But then it's before she completed the resolution, she went right back to when she was two or three, all the way through the age of 13 with her alcoholic father, and then having that same fear that she had when she fell. And that was on Monday. The occupational therapist re-evaluated her. So her pain was 10 out of 10. She had full discoloration, everything that you see in the syndrome. And so the occupational therapist evaluated her on Wednesday, and all of it was gone. And the physician saw her Wednesday afternoon, and he called and he said, "I don't know what you do. I don't really understand all of it, but I'm sending all my you know, regional complex pain syndrome patients to you instead of to these other physicians that are doing surgeries and injections and that." And that, I actually, Brent, I was extremely, I mean, I am extremely impressed by what it is that I witnessed. Well, I'm going to see her tomorrow, and we'll take it the next step wherever that is. But that was just one treatment.
David, and this is her right hand.
That's her right hand.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, it
yeah.
Was
so where totally it occurs? Classic. Yeah, it already. Yeah, it's consistent, yeah. Right? The whole mapping thing. Yeah. So. Yeah, dad. And she doesn't have any problem with her left hand. Her left hand's okay? Yeah.
No.
All right.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's mapping itself out. We can see it. You know, the more I do the work, the more I'm getting correlations between the site locations. And that's what I said today. All of these people with these medical things came up with prehistory events. Prior to the surgery, prior to the hip problem, they had had a previous hip thing. Prior to the tinnitus, had a sound thing. Prior to the cancer, like, what is it that wasn't safe? He's like, oh, well, my left side of my lungs, my body, my mother left us for 2 years. And exactly over his heart meridian, there's a pain there where mother was gone. And I'm like, this is like more than it looks like. This is really a major. Like, yeah, my mother disappeared for 2 years. She told us she was going to show up in Colombia and then never did. Like, oh my God, there's like a complete void in his left lung energy field where he's getting no love, no safety, no nurturing. So you look back on that and like, wow, you know, Dr. Mariko Tanaka said, you know, this changes the psychopathology model. It's not a matter of some medical diagnosis. It's like, how does the medical pain cue us to the memory site that has already been traumatized and is distorted, and you're getting it. You're right there in the middle of it, David. So that's great.
And Brent, I specialize in craniosacral therapy, so I have very sensitive hands. And it was so interesting because when she went into the memory, I could palpate where in the brain that memory was from the fall. And then when she switched
Interesting.
to the other memory, it was right next to in her brain in the cortex. It was right next to where the other memories were. And so all of her memories were located in that same area of her
Same
brain, and I could
area.
palpate it very clearly.
Wow,
Yeah, so that
cool.
is fascinating. So really tuning
Excellent.
into it.
Excellent. Yeah, document that, please, if you would. That would be great. Yeah,
David,
I
did you
think.
get pictures of her before her hand before and after?
You know, I didn't, and that's a really good thing that I will start doing,
Good.
particularly in cases like that. I'm
Yeah.
not sure if the occupational therapist did or
They might
didn't,
have, yeah, so.
but she may have, and because it would be, I mean, that would be really, and it was just incredible to hear about what happened just after that one treatment.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exciting, you know, and you're like, oh, they're running their colors through their body, and they're,
Yeah.
you know,
Yeah.
it's a memory, it's a series of memories. But that kind of abusive alcoholic relationship going on, that part of the body that's compromised. So what you're seeing is the actual proof of our understanding that certain memories compromise, you know, the rage, the anger, the witnessing the violence, not being able to do anything about it, the terror, the fear. And then one injury occurs, and it's the straw that breaks the camel's back, and suddenly pain levels is out of 10. And you know, what are, you know, how much of it is connected to memory? And you always hope that it could be 100% memory based. And sometimes you get the miracles. It really is like, wow, this really is from what we're seeing. It's all in her right hand. And you know, and we've always said where you're more vulnerable to injure yourself is where you already have all that trauma and fear and kind of shaky instability, terror. So it's kind of, that's fascinating that it helps to confirm, you know, that trauma predisposes later physiological damage or injury, or certainly, as you're seeing, exacerbates it, you know. Yeah. And I think there's a way to talk to doctors about this. Like there's a science, a language where you're smarter, you can explain this to him. Most of them are somewhat, you know, like here's what's happening neurologically. But Karen's book, The Cases, and if they can see it, read. And that's where I think putting in the explanation and the science, like that doctor needs the chapter from Lawrence along with the case to understand that this is like, we understand how this is working now. We see how it's transforming. And maybe we need a little more measurement on how the color shifted the brain waves or your brain wave correction shifted the put in the safety signal. You know, how are we going to prove that the client came up with her missing colors and when she moved it through, prove that she was safe? And so the body didn't need to hold on to the trances from the alcoholic father. Ultimately, that is what we want to prove. And I've known it. You know, you felt it. I feel it. We know it's happening. It's like, so we're going to go through the research protocols. We're going to take the time we need to show them what the body's doing. But I think we have something that's really highly effective for the body. So your practices, you know, there were cases where you will be very successful and remarkably, excitingly so, that the more pain in the body is memory based, the more successful it will be. The more there's actual damage and it's been left too long, there will still be a need for allopathic medicine and surgeries and things, given how long they've left things damaged in the system. But that being said, there's a lot we can do, a lot more return. You're feeling the shock. I felt like, oh my God, a lot more is memory based in the body than we thought. You know, we were thinking it's so physiological and we just have to do some physical therapy for it. Well, you're like giving a whole new definition to PT here. Like, okay.
Oh, no.
So you're trans PT here, something like that. So, you know, it's a different approach and you're incorporating the big picture. So it's integrative, you know? So that's exciting. Yay. Yeah. All right. Thanks for sharing that. That's so cool. And I did a couple of cases where I've been working with the parents in long distance. Like I worked on a skin condition with a mother holding, the daughter's 2 years old. She's not verbal very much, but had molluscum skin condition. I'm trying actual energy transmission for viruses. And, you know, I can do warts, fever, blisters. So I'm testing out right now to see if the viral transmission corrections also works for long distance anyway. So I had the mother hold the daughter because I've done it in person with the child with molluscum and we've had a virus go away, but I'm trying to see if the mother hold, like after you, what you did, have the mother hold the daughter, see what the colors are that come up. Is there any other trauma attached and run the colors to your daughter and see if the viral condition's clear. So I'm combining some of what we've done with some experimentation about viral clearing and other stuff. So we'll see.
And let's all start publishing. You know, talk to these PT people. I have a PT lady who said, my favorite magazine I read every month is, and she said, I think I'm going to write an article about what has happened with the client I referred to you. And so let's just get these publications, these stories out, because they're just too exciting.
Yeah,
they're really good.
So Excellent. Remind me, Karen, what you're actually doing. Are you writing a book on this? Or
I'm writing a book until somebody else comes in and writes the book. I'm kind of reluctantly, but I am working with some literary folks and to get their input on it, and have been for a bunch of months. So it's progressing, but it'll start with my story and then an introduction to HMR. And then each chapter is probably gonna be, for example, safe scene first, and then the body, and then the icons, and then go, you know, until we get to the color, go through the procedure. I'm not sure that's what's going to be the accepted final, but in each chapter, there'll be a little bit of how it was effective in my story and without a lot of drama, you know, not a lot of graphic details because that scares the reader, but how it's changed my life because I was 100% disabled by two rheumatologists had declared me 100% disabled. Yeah. And my counselors, I went to counseling talk therapy for 10 years. And after three sessions with Brent, I went back to my regular counselor. She threw down her notepad and said, I never had any hope you would get to this level of healing because of your dissociative levels. Mm. And she would not recommend EMDR for me. She thought I was too gone dissociatively. Wow. If that's a word. And so each chapter will also be stories from clinicians and HMR practitioners. And there are three doctors who recommend clients to me now, patients to me. So I'm hoping they'll include some of their stories. And I'll also have the QEEGs. And Jeanette and I are analyzing the software data. So under the color chapter, which the literary people are real excited about right now, we'll tell, for example, out of 1,000 HMR memories, 30% of them used blue in the reframe or green. And I don't know, if y'all know anybody who does statistics and can help analyze data, that's something we really need as well, because we've got a huge data dump. but I don't know which colors relate to fear, for example. You know, it's going to take a lot to match up what color is used for what purpose, or maybe even what part of the body often uses a color. So we have a lot of really fascinating data. And that person will show up who will help us analyze that as well.
Well,
I've got to go.
Okay.
Good Thanks, to see David. You all.
Yeah, we've done an hour and a half, so good job, everybody. Anybody else have any questions or things you needed to bring up or other cases?
I do.
Yeah. Heather, what's up?
Hi there.
Are you at home? Where are you? You
look like
you're
at home.
You're in a palazzo. It looks good.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. It's been nice out finally today. It's been a little cold out. I actually seems to, this is kind of half annoying to me and half not, because I'm nice to people and I like to help them, but I have friends who always call me for help. And then they're in the middle of some huge problem and I don't charge them because they don't have the money. So it's been happening again. So my friend Lisa, and actually Karen, you might be interested in some of her stories. Actually, I should write them down for you, but I helped her a while back out of a really bad marriage situation. She was stuck in Italy. And so she got out, came to the US, got back to California, and out just recently, and she's been doing really well, decides somehow to get involved with this guy who had been an ex-meth addict. And this is why I left you a message earlier, because I was like, oh, this is weird. Because I told her, be careful, even if he's an ex-addict, that usually they end up going back. This has been my experience just from knowing people who had, I knew someone.
Yeah, crystal meth is a really bad addiction. It's really awful.
Yeah. And then, yeah, and I think this guy has got like multiple personalities now, possibly. And then like, it was getting to the point where I had to tell her to call the police. Like, it was not good. So I've been on the phone with her, trying to help her. And then I was like wondering, does HMR even work for that kind of drug addiction once something like that happens? I'm just out of curiosity. But
with the active addict, the ideal is that, no, you're not going to be able to work with a person that's not in a,
right,
an emotionally stable, you know. HMR is really probably best. Well, Scott worked with people. I think Scott, in your clinic, probably some people were recently detoxed or detoxing, maybe sometimes.
He's going to go now, I guess.
And they were there.
He's going to go now.
The clients in my residential clinic, they stayed for 90 days, and just about every one of them had just detoxed prior to coming in.
Yeah.
And generally, their childhoods were so lacked nurturing to such a degree, and were so abusive and so neglectful without much support, that even if I did 30 sessions with them and cleared 60 traumas, like major, powerful traumas, they still would, when they left there, after 90 days, their emotional level, like depression and anxiety, would be at a zero when they left. But when they came in, they would usually be 8, 9, 10 out of 10 for depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And even if I used HMR to clear every single trauma that we could even find, most of them would relapse the first week or two after they left, because nothing was being done to change the core belief systems in the subconscious that are created by all these experiences. And so my last couple of years there, I started to help them to change their self, to improve their core self-esteem, core beliefs about themselves, and really, really severely traumatized clients that have never had much support. Just clearing their traumas with HMR is not enough for them to not relapse. You've got to address their core belief systems. And I've recently taken some hypnosis so I could learn how to do that on a much more thorough, deep level to reprogram their core beliefs. And so if you have a higher functioning client, just clearing their traumas with HMR usually succeeds. But if they're not that high functioning, then often clearing their traumas there's still some missing pieces with a negative core beliefs.
I see.
So not just the negative core. I mean, the beliefs are there, but if active addiction is there, the addictions are primary, like alcoholism. If they're still drinking, you can try reframing all you want, but they're on a drug that inhibits alpha theta. If they're drunk, I've done it on a couple of people still intoxicated in the treatment center because they were about to destroy the detox room. But in reality, you would not do HMR on an active.
What are you doing?
Oops. You would not do HMR on an active drug addict.
He was fine and then he relapsed recently.
What else have been doing today?
I don't even.
I'm at the end of.
Karen Lewis, you need to unmute your screen.
Monthly thing.
Oh. Jeanette, are you there?
So I don't know. I guess now the key's gotten.
Yes, I am.
We need to mute Karen for a moment. She's in another conversation.
All right. Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm
sorry. You were saying. So people, my basic principle is if they're 3 months, 6 months, but crystal meth addiction, he could be sober for or stable for a period of time, abstinent. And it's not really like Scott was saying, by the time they've gotten used to this as a very intensive addiction, it takes some period of time of stability, proven stability. So 12-step program, some kind of structure recovery, participation. The 12-step things are important. I'm a licensed addictions counselor. I developed this as relapse prevention.
Okay,
I didn't develop this as the necessarily as the primary source of abstinence and stability. You know, because if you don't have the client stabilized, grounded, and like Scott said, this is the whole belief system of the person. This is if they're from an abusive family, they're attracting unstable partners, her history. Now, the one person you and I can influence you to some extent would be to try to help her get some boundaries.
Yeah,
but that means number
she's
one big flag coming up is her reparenting. Her subconscious is attracting active, addicted nightmares.
Yeah, but she's realized there's a big codependent situation going on. She's finally figuring it out. And I haven't really been doing the HMR on her recently because it's kind of a boundary issue for me too.
If she's a friend, you can't often have to refer them to somebody and say, I can't do this with you. Because it's going to mess with your relationship boundaries or something that you work on very nicely. So, take a look at that. Oh. And so professionally, you know, you'll have to take a look at that. Look at what you do boundary wise, because, you know, our personal histories often dictate our approaches in our businesses as well to our clients. Mm-hmm. And you know your history. You know if there was any codependent manager functions that you internalized from any of your parents. Was there a codependent parent? Was there a counterdependent parent? So we tend to replicate that in our work environment. So it's an opportunity for you to take a look and say, I wish I can't really help you with this, but I can refer you to somebody
that
would do this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's different from, you know, HMR as a friend and HMR professionally. You know, you have to really be in a clean, calm, quiet place and not be invested in their lives to really be the clear observer.
Right.
And to hold the space for them. If you get too close, too involved, it's compromised and they don't benefit, you don't benefit, you know, and you feel guilty like, oh, she's my friend. I wish I could. But it's sad when there's not somebody and the resources aren't available for those around.
That's part of the problem, I feel like, because there's no money that, like, for the people who don't have the money. I think that, I mean, even with my friend who passed away, you know, there was no other option for this person. So I did as part of my, you know, my case studies.
Right.
And it's the same with her. I'm like, how do these people get the help they need when they don't have the funds? It's kind of
it's the same thing. I don't take insurance. Somebody texted me recently for Medicare and I'm like, no, I don't take Medicare. But if you're in this area, this person is certified in HMR and is married to a person that runs the clinic and they may take Medicare or do some plan with you in the region. So find out if there's somebody nearby that they could be with it. You got to find out what their resources are.
Yeah.
But in the end, it is very sad.
Yeah. But, at least he's going to rehab now. We'll see what happens, but I don't know.
Well, that's good.
That's
a start.
Warning, but yeah.
But you know, the real thing, like when I hear that, I hear her attraction history. What is her parenting profile? So I go straight to what in the world would have you coming back to such a destructive you know, addictive type personality. She has an alcoholic father, mother, or both in her history. She's not done her own reparenting. She's not done her own reframing. And that's a significant amount of therapy to do that kind of corrective work. You know, Scott was saying, you know, if you don't reset your attractor, your conscious mind can do all kinds of things and work on all little level one and two memories. But if the core belief system and the unconscious attracting mechanism is still set on an abusive dad, an abusive mom, and you're still sending out that unconscious signal, she'll switch over and do an alcoholic next time. And then she'll do a narcissist who's going to blame her for everything that she's ever done. Then she's going to switch to, you know, it'll just be a series of people and they'll keep repeating the pattern as long as the subconscious intentionality isn't corrected. HMR doesn't target just the conscious mind. It targets the subconscious attractor. Mm-hmm. And if you see them, you know, by the time they get to addictions and destructive marriages, that's the outermost circle of the defense mechanism. HMR was designed to eventually take people when they're ready all the way to the central core, which is, you know, shame. Shame is at the core. And if you're attracting, marrying, dating, trying to fix a crystal meth addict, there's a whole lot wrong with that picture. You know, you think that's love. He's so not in his body, so checked out, so absent. You know, it's like, wow, my question would be, what kind of definition of love does she have from her childhood? And you probably, you know, the answer to that, but it's like, you know, it's very frustrating when you see the trauma levels go all five layers all the way to, but you know, I always see a soul, like, what did she come in to work on in this lifetime? What is she here to do? You're not here to end up with an addict. If she's done this, not the first time she's been in a relationship with an addict. If you see the pattern three, four, five times and they get increasingly destructive, her soul, her body saying, you are here to stop this pattern, to do it differently. You know, you've done it three, four, five times. Look at it. If you see a pattern three times, you're here to end it in this lifetime. So along with the trauma overwhelm that you see from some of your clients, I try to see them through the spiritual hopeful lens at the same time. Like, I had a client this week. She's like, yeah, my dad was alcoholic. My mother was narcissistic and alcoholic, but the narcissist victim. Dad was more the CEO, aggressive, narcissist, alcoholic. And I'm like, wow, you came in to be sober. You came in to not be a narcissist. She's actually a nurse in a healthcare profession. Oh, cool. I'm like, you know, you can see how your soul, you see what you came in. Yeah, I stopped drinking 7 years ago. I said, excellent. That's a great starting point. That's the client you want to walk into your office and say, yeah, I got sober, but I'm stuck and I'm having trouble making healthy decisions. And, you know, what's the next step? And I'm like, that's why you're here. And your clients will walk in and they'll be there at 35, 41, 42, 49, 56. They're coming in at these anniversaries of their next stage of transition. Mm-hmm. And they're coming in because it's every 7 years you have a new body. So they're ending a cycle. I had a woman coming in. She's like, oh my God, I've been married to a narcissist for 30 something years. I didn't see it. Couldn't see it. My father was a narcissist. She married literally the man in front of her that looked and acted just like her father. But initially he was so charming and presented so well and looked so good, but you know, she couldn't see it. And in the end, he's an exact replica, but she's risen to her power. She's seeing the whole pattern. She's like, oh my God, you're going to have folks get ready. Because after the Trump era, no politic comment intended, but after the Trump era, we're all learning about personality disorders and narcissism. It's got to be, and this past week, it's 60 to 70% of the women I saw all dealing with narcissists.
Oh my gosh.
Like it's in their face. Like I couldn't see it before, but now everybody knows about narcissism. We're all learning about narcissism and it's so destructive. Plus they're in their 50s and 60s and their health is not being taken care of by a narcissist. They're at high risk of health risk, danger, injury. The narcissist will not be there for you. I'm sorry, I have a golf tournament to go to. Let me put you in the taxi and send you to the ER. Happens all the time, folks. Like, oh my God, you're kidding me. Like, no, he wasn't there. Yeah, I had a crisis. And he's like, I said, well, does he check you into coach and go sit in his seat in first class? She turned to me and said, no, he flew home before we did and left us to take care of the mess that was left. I'm like, oh my goodness gracious. Okay. So they're getting it. We're all learning. We're all, the whole society is in learning about personality level trauma. Personality disorder level trauma. We are all in that stage right now. we're shifting it up. Like the narcissists look good, sound good. And a huge percentage of corporate CEOs, and I'm talking to Dominic Aversa with his book, you know, but a huge percentage of corporate CEOs are narcissists. In fact, I had some of my clients that were pro-Trumpers that said, well, we like the fact that he's a narcissist. He's more aggressive than your usual business manager, and he kind of railroads his way through things, so he gets things done. And some bought into it, like, yeah, we like the fact that he's more self-centered and egotistical. He's a New Yorker. What can we say? You know, like, well, not really. New Yorkers hate him, but anyway, neither here nor there. But incorporating the bigger picture, you're going to see a lot of elevated clients dealing with this narcissism phenomenon, because they're all waking up to it at the same time. Like, oh my God, you're right. He doesn't really have empathy. And the thing about the narcissistic spouse is they have to marry an empathic person, or the children will not be stable, grounded, and come out of it okay. It looks like research says 25% of narcissism may be genetically predisposed. 75% is learned, acquired through experiences. So it looks like the kid's genetics might be okay. Although I had one this week, she said, no, my oldest daughter is a narcissist. Like her father, the other daughter's fine, is okay. So there is a genetic propensity, but we're not going to see the narcissists in our offices. That's not going to occur. They don't have a problem. Okay, so anyway, you're going to be seeing, and so my clients walk in, and I'm like, yeah, I'm divorcing right now. I said, well, you're married to a narcissist. And probably majority of the time they'll say, how did you know that? I was like, because we're all coming through. Yeah, I know, this past 4 years, oh my God, you know, everybody knows what a narcissist is now. We're all waking up to understand what that's about. So we're moving trauma to another level. So Scott's right in the fence, since that we're dealing with more than beliefs, we're dealing with developmental characterological trauma before the age of 5 sometimes. And I don't know about you, but I haven't seen a great success rate treating narcissists. So if you find a technique, a way to adapt HMR for, but I don't think we're going to see them in our office. I mean, I have a couple of clients that it's clear that the mental and emotional abuse occurred before the age of moral reasoning, rational development, and before the age of ethics, and before the age of empathy. And when the development is stunted at such a young age, even if you try HMR and they try to reframe, they don't seem to be picking up the developmental stages that they missed out on. Now, Scott and I, you and I have talked about that, about, you know, nurturing the person back into their adult self, into some kind of self. And something needs to be written about that. And I'm certainly open to looking at that. But it just looks like if certain developmental stages, you'd have to tell me what your opinion is about that. But if certain developmental stages of nurturing do not occur, and they get locked into this fearful rigidity or anger and entitlement, it seems very hard to get them to resume development and mature into an empathic, kind, rational being.
So Brent, I actually started working with that the last couple of years that I was working with the drug addicts, and their second session, I would always have them go to their safe place, meet their inner child there. And then whatever age would pop up would give us some information.
Baseline.
And mm-hmm. Yeah. And how the inner child would respond to them would also tell you how much of distance was created between the inner child and the adult person. And I would have them go visit their inner child every day to reparent them for about 5 minutes, and then to go to the safe place, put color through them every day. And these are severely neglected, abused children that became adult alcoholics or drug addicts. And usually those that nurtured their child every day, within about 3 to 4 weeks, the child would become older. So like if the original child, if the original child was 5 years old, a few weeks later, the child is 7 or 8, they're stronger, they would keep nurturing. And those that stayed with it, usually a child would go from 5 to 15 or 16 within a couple months, if they were very consistent with it, and the adult personalities would change at the same time. So by nurturing the inner child, in most cases that I remember, that child would actually grow developmentally and emotionally as they were reparented internally by the adult addict. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't keep statistics on it to know for sure, because a lot of drug addicts aren't that consistent with their, you know, their right. homework and everything. And so you never know, but it definitely worked. And the adult personality would change as the inner child would grow, expand, feel more safe, more loved.
So did you work with some of these as, were they ever tagged narcissists, some of these women? Were they narcissistic personality disorders, do you know? My concern is like, well, with the males, I don't know how we even get them started with the realization they even need to reframe. It's almost like the development of this thing is so early in the entitlement, they don't see the need to parent themselves on a regular basis, you know? The biggest thing is that when they're confirmed as a victim, I'm a victim, I feel entitled to be a victim. I, you know, this is what they did to me. They're angry at being the victim, shifting them from the victim posture to the self-nurturing. Although I have one client I may try that with, actually it might be helpful. So I'm going to work with her with that. It'd be interesting.
Well, I think most drug addicts were so deprived of their needs that many of them are very self-centered, but over time, as they start to heal their traumas, that can shift. But a similar type of personality to what you're talking about were children that were never held accountable by their parents, never disciplined, never said no, never had to be accountable for anything. They could break all the rules, they could hurt anybody. And that is kind of similar to what you're talking about. And those clients, I would sit down the very first session and I would say, the only way I can help you is if you are willing to address these behaviors to where you don't care about anybody else. You don't follow the rules. You're never accountable. It's beyond anything I can help you with. But if you decide you want to change, then I did see clients that could change that if they were honest about it and willing to actually address their behaviors, which is totally going against what their parents treated them is
ignoring
you. Right. Yeah. You are never wrong. You never make mistakes. You can hurt people. Nothing you do is consequence. And the only person that can change them is when they decide I'm tired of it. I've got to change.
I do it differently.
Then they, right. Yeah. Then they can change.
Okay. Yeah. So that's where we're interested in extending HMR into these realms where, if we can at least get them out of enough of an entitlement, angry victim posture to find a way to accept a self-nurturing potential and to set boundaries. I've done that with them in the past. And when they could get the adult to set a boundary, suddenly, oh wow, my inner child is here and is listening to me. It's like they've been waiting for somebody to tell them what to do and not do and set a boundary. Right. That's interesting. We'll pursue more discussion about that in the future and look at maybe if cases that will come up for us inevitably about that. But it's always interesting taking the trauma piece down to the core foundation developmentally where this occurred. We need to work more with that. I just haven't been in a treatment center that gave access to, probably when I was inpatient with addictions, it was easier than it has been in the last decade. So. Good work, everybody. Any other comments, questions? All right, everybody.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit more about the research you're doing with the brain, you know, the brain scans and all that? Just a little bit more. I'm not sure what you're doing because I'm starting to get some ideas.
Have you seen that, Scott? Have you seen what we did? Have you seen the QEEG data? You know, we might have Karen, if you want to do it, I can do it too. I could do a presentation for you all. How can we do that? PowerPoints are kind of tricky with these screens. I can talk to Jeanette, maybe at the beginning of the next, or maybe we need to combine both groups at some point, offer it to both groups, the certified group and the non-certified group, and do, you've done a presentation, Karen, already for some groups, haven't you?
Yes. Retired social worker group. I had 100 in the last group and used that PowerPoint. And then I've also done it for the certified group.
That's what I thought. So one thing we may want to do is set up a time and invite everybody to do that and have Mary Gaddy there with us, maybe interpreting some of the QEG data. And she might have some people from a research group that would want to observe this also and what we did with that. Maybe go a little deeper into some of the QEGs. But we have some of that summarized already, Scott. We have some PowerPoints and some things. So I should be able to email you something about that.
Yeah, Jeanette has it on a Dropbox, and we can send you a link to the Dropbox. Yeah,
that would be good.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So you can review that. And I mean, we had hundreds of QEG pictures to sort out and kind of prioritize, like it doesn't make sense, some of it and the vast body of it. So we had to consolidate it into what's easily recognizable and the most articulate. But we're going to be having a lot more of that data coming in. And that's our goal. So,
okay.
We have two Dropbox links. One of them is the PowerPoint that is a summary, and the other is all the data. And you can access the summary. We can give to anybody we want to give it to. Yeah. It's public, and we use it with our seminars. And then the entire database, you have to go through Jeanette and sign a waiver because it includes so much information, personal information. There she is.
Hey, hi.
Jeanette, can you send that to Scott? Because you have his email.
I'll take care of Scott.
Okay, cool.
I'll send you an email, Scott, and get you you want the full data? You want to look at the full data? Because I can send you the waiver.
Yes, or at least an interpretation of that data, like a summary of what's going on.
What I'll do is send you the summary first. And if you want more, then we'll do the waiver and you can get all the data.
Okay, bye. Janet, I want to help that too. Can I access to that too?
Yes. I will make a note and send you guys. We'll start with the summary, and then if you want to get more, then I'll just have you sign the waiver and you can get more. Mm-hmm. Everybody, so I'm seeing Bill and Erico and Scott.
Bob wants it too. Are you saying bye, Bob, or you want the data? Okay. Yeah, he wants the data too.
Okay. I will do that, guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Stay healthy. Stay well.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Sure. Thanks again.
Bye.
Ciao, y'all. Yeah.